Hello everyone, before we begin this episode, I just wanted to once again remind you that during the month of February, The Trail Went Cold has been partnering with Season of Justice, a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping families shed new light on their unsolved cold cases. We thank you so much for your support thus far, but as a refresher, Season of Justice provides grants to investigative agencies that fund DNA testing and forensic genetic genealogy research to solve cold cases. And it also helps fund such resources as billboards, which spread awareness about these unsolved cold cases and urge people to come forward if they have information. Since 2020, Season of Justice has raised over $1 million in grants for more than 140 cold cases in North America, and at the time of this recording, 6 of these cases have been solved. But they still need the support of listeners like you, which is why we're asking if you would consider donating and helping bring victims' families ever so closer to a resolution. We still have 1 week left in our campaign, so to donate to Season of Justice, please visit the website givebutter.com/SOJ_thetrail or text trail24 to 53555. You'll also find links and information about this in our show notes and on our social media pages, and we have a donate button on our website at trailwentcold.com. Like I just mentioned, our campaign with Season of Justice is lasting the entire month of February, and there will be one more reminder on our final episode this month. So thank you very much for your support, and enjoy part one of our special two-part anniversary episode.
June 9th. 1959, Clinton, Ontario. After failing to return home, 12-year-old Lynn Harper is reported missing, and her body is discovered in a woodlot 2 days later. She has been sexually assaulted and strangled to death with her own blouse, and suspicion turns toward her 14-year-old classmate, Stephen Truscott, who claims he gave Lynn a ride to the highway on his bicycle and saw her climb into a car. Stephen is soon charged, convicted, and sentenced to death for Lynn's murder, but his sentence is commuted to life in prison and he is paroled in 1969. Decades later, Stephen files a successful appeal to have his conviction overturned, but the question of who actually killed Lynn remains up for debate. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello everyone and welcome to another special milestone for The Trail Went Cold, our 8-year anniversary show. I'm your host Robin Warder, and whenever we commemorate our podcast anniversary each year, I always like to go the extra mile and put together a special 2-part episode. And this time around, we'll be doing a deep dive into one of the most famous criminal cases in the history of our podcast's home country of Canada, the 1959 murder of Lynn Harper. That voice you just heard narrating our intro was Sarah Browning, the latest winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Sarah. This is a recurring monthly contest which we've been carrying on for 6.5 years now, so if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions near the end of this episode. Anyways, you may or may not know, Canada does not currently have the death penalty, as our country's last execution took place all the way back in 1962, and the story we'll be talking about today has often been cited as a major turning point in influencing Canada's decision to abolish capital punishment in 1976. The victim in this case is 12-year-old Lynn Harper, who was sexually assaulted and murdered just outside the small town of Clinton, Ontario, but her name probably isn't as well known as the person who was charged and convicted of the crime, Stephen Truscott. Stephen was only 14 years old at the time, and while he continually maintained his innocence, he was found guilty at trial and sentenced to death by hanging. Well, needless to say, this verdict was the source of major controversy, as a number of people believed that even if Stephen committed this crime, there were major ethical issues with executing a 14-year-old. His sentence was eventually commuted to life imprisonment, and after he was paroled in 1969, Stephen started a new life under a new name and stayed completely out of the spotlight. But the case continued to remain shrouded in controversy, and 3 decades after his release from prison, Stephen decided to make an exerted effort to clear his name, and the Court of Appeal for Ontario finally overturned his conviction in 2007. However, even though the court acknowledged that a miscarriage of justice had occurred, there was not enough exculpatory evidence to give Stephen a declaration of factual innocence, and this only raised another troubling question. If Stephen Truscott did not actually kill Lynn Harper, then who did? Over the years, I've received a few requests to cover this case, but it wasn't until last year, when I read the book, Until You Are Dead, Stephen Truscott's Long Ride into History, written by journalist Julian Cher, which is one of the most detailed and in-depth true crime books I've ever come across, and will be just one of the many sources I use on this series of episodes. Since this upcoming June will mark the 65th anniversary of Lynn Harper's murder, I thought now would be a good time to finally tackle it, but since it's such a convoluted story, I will need to break it down into 2 parts. So on this particular episode, I'll share all the main facts of the case up until about 2006, and then provide the rest of the story, as well as my theories and analysis, when I release part 2 next week. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or a review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. As our Patreon page currently has nearly 70 exclusive bonus episodes in our archives, which are not available on our regular feed. So with all that out of the way, let us now start exploring the murder of Lynn Harper. Our story begins in 1959 in Clinton, Ontario, a small town located in Huron County, which had a population of around 2,600 people at that time. Our victim is 12-year-old Cheryl Lynn Harper, who goes by her middle name, and lives with her parents, Leslie and Shirley Harper, along with her 2 brothers, 16-year-old Barry and 5-year-old Jeffrey. Lynn was originally born in New Brunswick, but since her father was a flying officer in the Royal Canadian Air Force, aka the RCAF, the Harper family relocated to Ontario in 1957 after Leslie was assigned to the base, RCAF Station Clinton, which at the time was the largest radar and telecommunications training center in the country. The Harpers took up residence in the permanent married quarters, and at this particular point in time, Lynn is a 7th grade student at Air Vice Marshal Hugh Campbell School, which was located on the north side of the base. At around 6:15 p.m. on the evening of Tuesday, June the 9th, Lynn left her residence in order to head to the school, as she was a member of the Girl Guides and wanted to help out with a scavenger hunt that the younger Girl Guide branch, the Brownies, were holding. But even though the scavenger hunt ended at around 7 o'clock, Lynn never returned home, so after it got dark, her parents went out searching for her. When they were unable to find Lynn, Leslie Harper went to the RCAF guardhouse in order to report his daughter missing at around 11:25 p.m., and they subsequently contacted the Ontario Provincial Police, aka the OPP. Before she left her residence, Lynn had gotten into an argument with her parents, as she wanted to go swimming at an outdoor pool on the base, which required adult supervision, but her parents did not want to accompany her there. At the outset, the authorities believed that this may have prompted Lynn to run away, though this narrative would change later on. Regardless, over the course of the next day and a half, there would be a massive search effort from the OPP and the RCAF to find her. Well, at around 1:50 p.m. on the afternoon of June the 11th, a pair of airmen were searching through a farm woodlot known as Lawson's Bush, which was located just outside the base on a 150-acre property owned by a farmer named Bob Lawson. They wound up coming across the decomposing body of Lynn Harper, who was lying on the ground on her back and had her own torn and blood-stained blouse wrapped around her neck. It turned out that she had been fatally strangled with her blouse, and the only clothing she had on was her bloody undershirt. Curiously, Lynn's shoes, socks, and zipped-up shorts were neatly placed next to her body, and her underwear was lying about 10 meters away. Lynn had a gash on her left shoulder and a large scratch on the front of her left leg, but even though she appeared to have injuries to her genital area and had likely been raped, this could not be determined with 100% certainty due to the level of decomposition on her vagina and the fact that no semen was found on or around her body. Three thick branches which were taken off some ash saplings in the woodlot were also resting on top of Lynn. Lawson's Bush was located next to County Road, and there was a tractor trail which ran from the road into the bush and was about 80 feet away from the spot where Lynn's body was found. The trail appeared to contain some bicycle tracks, which would be the source of some controversy, but we'll get back to that later. The lead investigator into Lynn's murder would be Inspector Harold Graham from the Criminal Investigations Bureau in Toronto, and the Ontario Attorney General offered what was then an unprecedented $10,000 reward for information leading to the capture of the killer. After speaking with a number of witnesses, Inspector Graham turned his focus towards a 14-year-old friend and classmate of Lynn's named Stephen Truscott, who was the last known person to see her alive. Even though there was a 19-month age difference between them, Lynn and Stephen were part of the same combined 7th and 8th grade class at Air Vice Marshal Hugh Campbell School, and Stephen was considered to be one of the most popular and athletic kids at their school. Stephen was originally born in Vancouver, British Columbia, to parents Dan and Doris Truscott, but since his father was a non-commissioned warrant officer in the RCAF, the Truscott family had to move around a lot during Stephen's youth. They originally arrived at RCAF Station Clinton in 1956, and now resided in the permanent married quarters, along with Stephen's older 16-year-old brother Ken, and his younger brother and sister, 9-year-old Bill and 6-year-old Barbara. On the morning of June 10th, after Lynn went missing, Leslie Harper had stopped by the Truscott residence while Stephen was eating his breakfast to ask if anyone had seen his daughter. Stephen told Leslie that sometime after 7 p.m. the previous evening, a number of kids were hanging around outside Air Vice Marshal Hugh Campbell School, and Lynn approached him while he was sitting on his bicycle. Even though they were not particularly close friends, Stephen and Lynn were acquainted with each other and had actually danced together at a party 5 days earlier. Stephen claimed that Lynn asked him for a ride to Highway 8 in order to visit a man named Edgar Hodges, who lived on a farm in the area and kept some ponies which Lynn wanted to see. The highway was located just over 1 kilometer north from the school, but Stephen was planning to go there anyway to see if some of his friends were hanging out at the nearby Bayfield River, so he agreed to give Lynn a ride. She then climbed under the crossbar of Stephen's bicycle, and he said that they left together at 7:25 p.m. Stephen would claim that he knew it was 7:25 by looking at a clock through the window of the school's kindergarten classroom, but the exact time Stephen and Lynn left would become yet another source of controversy throughout the investigation. Whatever the case, Stephen said that he rode his bicycle north on County Road and would pass by Lawson's Bush, the spot where Lynn's body was found 2 days later. During their trip, Lynn told Stephen that she was upset with her parents for not letting her go swimming at the pool, but he did not believe she seemed overly angry. After traveling another 2,000 feet, they crossed a concrete bridge which ran over the Bayfield River, and Stephen would say that he saw some boys there. They then arrived at the intersection of County Road and Highway 8, and since Edgar Hodges' farm was located about a half kilometer east, Lynn was apparently planning to travel the rest of the way on her own. After Lynn climbed off the bike, Stephen said that he turned around and started heading south down County Road in the opposite direction. When he reached the bridge, Stephen stopped in order to watch some kids playing in the river, and then turned his head to look back at Highway 8. He claimed that he saw Lynn sticking her thumb out at the intersection when a car pulled over and she climbed inside before it headed east. Stephen believed that the vehicle was a gray-colored 1959 Chevrolet with chrome and large fins on the back. While he couldn't be certain, he felt that it might have been a Chevy Bel Air. Stephen also noticed something on the rear fender which appeared to be yellow or orange, such as a license plate or bumper sticker, though an alternate explanation which has been pushed forward is that it could have been a glare from the sun. Regardless, Stephen did not find the situation to be unusual, and he proceeded to ride back to the school and arrive sometime after 8 p.m. Since Stephen had to babysit his younger brother and sister, he returned home at approximately 8:25. Well, Leslie Harper soon shared Stephen's story with the OPP, and they got in touch with Edgar Hodges, who confirmed that Lynn never showed up at his farm the previous night. Later that morning, while Stephen was attending school, OPP Constable Donald Hobbs asked Dan Truscott to pull his son out of class, and Hobbs proceeded to interview Stephen in the back of his patrol car. Stephen told the same story he had shared with Leslie, and over the course of the next few days, he would be interviewed multiple times and stick to a consistent version of events, and he also did not appear to show any visible stress or frustration over the frequent questioning. At one point, OPP Constable Donald Tremblay asked Stephen and his mother to accompany him to the intersection of County Road and Highway 8, where he claimed he had dropped Lynn off. However, Inspector Harold Graham became very suspicious of Stephen's story. He found it very odd that Stephen would travel north on County Road past Lawson's Bush, drop Lynn off at Highway 8, witness her climb into a car which was traveling east, and then some unknown killer would circle back and travel south in order to murder Lynn in Lawson's Bush. On the evening of June 12th, only one day after the discovery of Lynn's body, Stephen was visiting Bob Lawson at his farm, as he often stopped by there to help Lawson do chores. As Stephen was leaving to head back home at around 7 p.m., he was suddenly intercepted by Constable Tremblay, who said that they wanted to ask him some more questions, and took him to the police station in the town of Godrich, located about 20 kilometers away. After they arrived, Stephen was asked to sign a statement outlining his original story before he was relentlessly interrogated by Tremblay and Inspector Graham without the presence of a guardian or an attorney. Stephen now realized that the police believed he was responsible for Lynn's murder and were trying to make him confess. Stephen continued to stick to his original story, so after a few hours, Graham decided to have the boy taken to the RCAF guardhouse in Clinton and also had one of his constables bring Stephen's father, Dan, there. While Dan was not happy that the police had been interrogating his son without his knowledge or consent, he did begrudgingly agree to the request to have a doctor perform a medical examination of Stephen. It was agreed that the Truscott family's physician, Dr. John Addison, would perform this exam, and he was assisted by the RCAF Station Clinton senior medical officer, Dr. David Hall Brooks, who had also helped out with Lynn's autopsy. Now, this would later turn out to be yet another source of major controversy in this case, as both doctors claimed that they discovered a pair of large lesions on Stephen's penis, which they described as being the size of a quarter. Stephen was directly asked if he had been masturbating, and while he admitted that he did, he also claimed that the lesions had been there for 4 or 5 weeks. Stephen would later say that these doctors greatly exaggerated how large these lesions were, but investigators believed that they were injuries that Stephen had sustained while he violently raped Lynn. Throughout the course of the interrogation, Stephen claimed that he was so exhausted that he started to become confused and disoriented. According to the original police notes, he allegedly made a statement to Dr. Addison about how he could have molested Lynn and not remembered it, though there's always been debate over the validity of this statement. Regardless, at 2:30 a.m. on the morning of June the 13th, after being questioned and examined for around 7 hours, Stephen was officially charged with first-degree murder under the provisions of the Juvenile Delinquents Act and held at the Huron County Jail in Godrich without bail. By the end of the month, it was ruled that Stephen would be tried for the crime as an adult rather than a juvenile, and after a preliminary hearing was held in July, it was determined that the case against Stephen was strong enough for him to stand trial. The situation took a huge toll on the Truscotts, as shortly after Stephen was charged with murder, The RCAF transferred Dan Truscott to their base in Ottawa, 600 kilometers away, and forced the family to move out of the permanent married quarters at RCAF Station Clinton. As a result, the Truscotts would be forced to rent a trailer in Goderich in order to attend Stephen's trial. Since the family did not have much money, a local defense attorney named Frank Donnelly agreed to represent Stephen pro bono. His trial would begin at the Huron County Courthouse in Goderich on September the 16th and was presided over by Justice Robert Ferguson, with Glenn Hayes as the Crown prosecutor. The Crown would attempt to argue that Stephen's story about dropping Lynn off at Highway 8 was false. Instead, while they were riding his bicycle together down County Road, Stephen turned off onto the tractor trail which led into Lawson's Bush, where he proceeded to rape and strangle Lynn to death. Now, the case against Stephen was very circumstantial, and you might have noticed that I haven't gone over much of the evidence against him yet. When describing the events of the trial, I'm going to be sharing much of the Crown's evidence, followed by the defense's counter to it, but keep in mind that a lot of key information was withheld, and I'll be going into more detail about that later on. Now, before I talk any more about the evidence, I want to share a quote that Julian Cher made in his aforementioned book about this case, Until You Are Dead, about Crown prosecutor Glenn Hayes. Cher described Hayes' style at the trial as a, quote-unquote, blizzard of details and suggestions, but with little hard fact beneath it all. And you could probably apply this quote to a controversial moment from Hayes' opening statement to the jury. As you recall, on the night he was charged with the murder, Stephen had been interrogated by the police for over 2 hours without the presence of an adult guardian before his father was brought to the RCAF guardhouse. When the trial started, Justice Ferguson had not yet decided if any statements that Stephen made or signed during those 2 hours would be admissible as evidence, as he had not been advised that anything he said could be used against him. Ferguson also had issue with the validity of the statement Stephen made, where he conceded that he could have molested Lynn and not remembered it, as he said this while being questioned by Dr. Addison, who was only supposed to perform a physical examination of Stephen rather than interrogate him. However, when addressing the jury, Prosecutor Hayes specifically stated that even though Stephen never confessed, he signed a statement when police first took him in for questioning. This prompted Justice Ferguson to dismiss the jury and admonish Hayes for saying this, informing him that if Stephen's original statements were not admitted into evidence, he might have to declare a mistrial. Inspector Graham later appeared on the witness stand at the trial to share Stephen's original statement, but Ferguson dismissed the jury beforehand and ultimately ruled that the statement was inadmissible. While Ferguson decided not to declare a mistrial, the defense feared that Hayes' calculated decision to mention a confession during his opening statement might have planted a false seed in the jury's minds that Stephen had admitted to the crime, even though he never did. Anyway, one key piece of evidence which caused a lot of questions was a locket that Lynn had supposedly been wearing on the night she was killed, which was an RCAF logo in a heart made of plexiglass hanging on a gold chain. Even though Stephen recalled Lynn wearing this locket when he last saw her, it was not hanging around her neck when her body was found. Well, on June the 19th, 8 days after the discovery of Lynn's body, a 10-year-old girl discovered a locket matching this description hanging from the lowest string of a barbed wire fence, which was located alongside County Road, about 280 feet away from the tractor trail which led into Lawson's Bush. The locket was soon shown to Lynn's parents, who identified it as the same locket she had been wearing on the night she went missing. The police had not found the locket during their original crime scene investigation, but curiously, on June the 18th, the day before it was found, OPP Corporal Hank Sayo had gone back to the scene to collect some soil samples from the spot right next to the fence where the locker had been hanging, and he didn't see it either. This led to speculation that Lynn's killer may have taken her locket and returned it to the scene at a later time in order to hang it on the fence, but the problem was that Stephen had already been charged with murder at this point and was in jail on June the 18th and 19th. When Leslie Harper testified at the preliminary hearing in July, he was certain the locket belonged to Lynn, but curiously, when he testified at Stephen's trial in September, he seemed to downplay the significance of the locket, stating, quote, Lynn had one similar to it. When Leslie was asked if he had positively identified the locket as belonging to Lynn on a previous occasion, he simply replied, quote, "I don't recall." Speaking of Lynn's parents, when Shirley Harper testified at the trial and was asked if Lynn had any history of running away or hitchhiking, she replied, quote, "Not to my knowledge, sir." This was meant to discredit Stephen's story that Lynn would have stuck out her thumb to hitchhike and climbed into a vehicle with a stranger. Of course, it would later turn out that Lynn did have a prior history of hitchhiking, and her parents had initially believed she ran away, but this information was not disclosed to the defense, and we'll get back to that topic as we go along. So now let's talk about the so-called physical evidence against Stephen, though there really wasn't much of it. Of course, there was no DNA testing back in 1959, and given the limited technology they had available, the only item from the murder scene which could be checked for fingerprints were Lynn's leather shoes, but no prints were found on them. The Crown claimed that bicycle track marks had been found on the tractor trail which turned off County Road into Lawson's Bush, which supposedly supported their case that Stephen had taken Lynn there. There was also some debate about whether a footprint had been found at the murder scene near Lynn's body. Even though none of the original police reports mentioned anything about footprints, an RCAF flying officer named Glenn Sage testified that when he was at the scene, he noticed a heel mark on the ground near Lynn's left heel, which appeared to be from a shoe with a crepe rubber sole, which was similar to shoes that Stephen was known to have been wearing at that time. But no casts or measurements were ever taken of this alleged heel mark, and it was not actually photographed until after Stephen was arrested. One of the few investigators who had doubts that Stephen was the right suspect was OPP Identification Officer Corporal John Erskine. When Erskine was called to the stand and asked if this alleged footprint was distinct enough to get an exact measurement, he replied no, and it was never conclusively linked to Stephen. I previously mentioned that bicycle tire tracks had been found on the tractor trail which led into Lawson's Bush, but while the Crown tried to allege that they were from Stephen's bike, Erskine testified that a definitive match could not be made. In fact, since the trail was dry and cracked and the ground was parched, Erskine believed that the tracks had been made when the dirt was wet. There had not been any rainfall in the area in the weeks prior to the murder, which seemed to suggest that the cracks were left there on a previous occasion and were completely unrelated to the case. When Stephen was in custody, the OPP got a warrant to search the Truscott residence and took a pair of red pants which were hanging on a clothesline. Doris Truscott told them that Stephen had worn these pants on the evening of June the 9th, and she washed them the following morning, as it was her ordinary routine to do her entire family's laundry on Wednesday mornings. However, investigators wondered if Stephen may have gotten blood or other incriminating evidence from the murder on his pants, and his mother immediately washed them to protect him. While some dark stains were found on the pants' knees, it turned out they were likely nothing more than ordinary grass stains. After Stephen was charged with murder, the police confiscated the underwear he had on at the time and claimed they found what appeared to be traces of sperm on them. They thought this might be evidence that Stephen had committed sexual assault, but it could not be determined if this was the same underwear he wore on the night of Lynn's murder, and there was also skepticism that he would be wearing the same unwashed pair 4 days after the fact. The Crown would also put heavy emphasis on the lesions which were discovered on Stephen's penis. When he testified at the preliminary hearing, Dr. John Addison acknowledged that the lesions could have been caused by masturbation, but by the time he testified at trial, he had completely discounted this theory. Instead, he expressed his belief that the lesions were caused by Stephen sexually assaulting Lynn, describing it as, quote-unquote, the result of an inexperienced male attempting penetration. There was another odd contradiction from Dr. David Hall Brooks, the medical officer who had examined the lesions. At the preliminary hearing, Brooks had testified that the lesions were 2 to 5 days old, but by trial, he narrowed the time frame down to 60 to 80 hours. When the defense asked Brooks why he made this change, he replied, quote, "I have since been burnt once, and I have seen how long it takes a lesion to heal under ideal conditions." Dr. Berkeley Brown, a specialist in internal medicine, was called upon as an expert witness by the defense and shared his opinion that the lesions were unlikely to have been caused by penetration. During World War II, Dr. Brown had performed medical exams on thousands of soldiers, a couple of whom had been accused of rape, but claimed he never saw any lesions like the one Stephen had on his penis. He testified that the penis was rarely injured during the act of rape, and if it did occur, the injury would usually be sustained at the head of the penis. Now that we're done talking about the physical evidence, we have to talk about the timeline and the eyewitness testimony in this case. Well, Stephen had initially believed that he left the schoolyard with Lynn at around 7:25 p.m., the Crown found other witnesses from the school who testified that Stephen and Lynn had left together at an earlier time, though no earlier than 7 o'clock. Regardless, it was well established that Stephen returned to the school on his bicycle alone shortly after 8 p.m., as numerous witnesses, including his older brother Ken, interacted with him there, and Stephen then went home to babysit his two younger siblings. So if Stephen was guilty, he would have needed to take Lynn from the school to Lawson's Bush to kill her, and then biked back to the school within a window of between 35 to 60 minutes. One of the big obstacles with the Crown scenario is that when Inspector Graham issued a police bulletin following the discovery of Lynn's body, he instructed officers to search for suspects who may have had scratches or cuts on their face, neck, hands, and arms, as he believed that Lynn likely put up a major struggle against her attacker. In fact, some traces of blood appeared to be under Lynn's fingernails, though it was never conclusively proven that it originated from scratching her attacker. But the problem is that none of the witnesses who interacted with Stephen at the school after 8 p.m. reported seeing any blood or scratches on him. Since it had been a hot summer night, it was assumed that Stephen would be out of breath and sweating profusely right after committing a rape and murder, but all of the witnesses seemed to think he was acting completely normal. When Stephen gave his first police interview to Constable Hobbs the following morning, he also did not notice any scratches on him, and aside from the lesions on his penis, none of the doctors who examined Stephen at the guardhouse saw any fresh cuts or scratches, aside from a scab on Stephen's upper thigh and some vertical scratches on his kneecaps and his arms, which were likely made prior to Lynn's murder. In spite of this, the Crown still produced two key eyewitnesses who alleged that Stephen and Lynn had gone into Lawson's Bush together that night. One of them was 13-year-old Jocelyn Gaudette, who also attended Air Vice Marshal Hugh Campbell School and told police that the day before the murder, Stephen had made a secret date with her to meet at Lawson's Bush as he wanted to show her some newborn calves at Bob Lawson's farm, and he asked Jocelyn not to tell anyone about it. At 5:50 p.m. the following night, Jocelyn claimed that Stephen stopped by her house to remind her about this upcoming date, but when she showed up at Lawson's Bush sometime later, he was not there, and she did not see him for the rest of the evening. So the implication pushed forward by the Crown is that Stephen had decided to break his date with Jocelyn in order to take Lynn into Lawson's Bush instead, where he proceeded to rape and murder her. However, there were credibility issues with Jocelyn, as she was not exactly known for being the most popular girl in school and had a history of exaggerating and embellishing her importance. For his part, Stephen denied ever having made a date with Jocelyn or stopping by her house at 5:50 on the night of the murder. In fact, Stephen claimed that he had left his house at around 5:50 in order to pick up some coffee for his mother at a nearby store before he returned home. Indeed, it did seem odd that Stephen would supposedly arrange a secret date with Jocelyn, which he wasn't supposed to tell anybody about, and then just flat out show up at her home to see her while her family was there. The other key witness was a 14-year-old friend of Stephen's named Arnold George, who went by the nickname Butch. The police became interested in Butch once rumors started circulating that he had been telling other children he saw Stephen and Lynn go into Lawson's Bush together on the night she was killed. Butch claimed that on the evening of June the 9th, he had paid a visit to the Truscott residence at around 8:45 p.m. and asked Stephen why he had given Lynn a ride on his bicycle. Stephen also mentioned that they had both gone into Lawson's Bush to look for a cow and a calf. The following evening, Stephen, Butch, and three other boys were hanging out together on the bridge which ran over the Banfield River when one of them asked if Stephen had taken Lynn into Lawson's Bush. Stephen said he didn't, and when he learned that Butch had shared the story, he confronted him, but Butch denied ever having said that. At some point that same night, Butch claimed that he paid another visit to the Truscott residence, and Stephen was panicky because he had told the police he saw Butch at the river while he was riding across the bridge with Lynn. Stephen now realized that he had mistaken Butch for another kid and asked him to lie to the police and tell him he saw Stephen on the bridge that night, which Butch agreed to do. Well, much like Jocelyn Gaudette, there were credibility issues with Butch, as he was known for being a troublemaker and pathological liar who liked to make up stories for attention. During his various statements to police, Butch often changed his story and contradicted himself, as he varied between saying that he quote-unquote heard Stephen was going into Lawson's Bush, or that he quote-unquote saw him go into Lawson's Bush. In fact, at no point did Butch ever provide any specific details about where and when he saw Stephen and Lynn enter the bush. When he testified on the witness stand at trial, Butch said that he had spent the early evening of June the 9th searching for Stephen, but could not find him until he paid a visit to the Truscott residence at 8:45 p.m. Once again, Stephen claimed that Butch never stopped by his house to see him on either June the 9th or the 10th, and he also denied asking Butch to lie to the police on his behalf. The police reports confirmed that Butch had originally told them he saw Stephen and Lynn at the bridge, but he later changed his story after claiming that Stephen had asked him to lie. Now, decades later, some additional police notes would be unearthed, which shed further light into how much Jocelyn and Butch changed their stories. However, the defense did not have access to all this information during the original trial, and I'll go into more detail about this in our next episode. Another witness who reported seeing Stephen and Lynn riding their bicycle on County Road on the night of the crime was a boy named Richard Galatley, who claimed that he was riding his own bike down the road and passed by them sometime after 7:25 p.m. But since the sighting took place near the school at a spot before Stephen would have reached Lawson's Bush, it didn't prove or disprove his involvement. However, the Crown would rely heavily on the testimony of a 10-year-old boy named Philip Burns, who had walked south down County Road that evening. He claimed that he bumped into Jocelyn and Butch on the road at separate times, who both asked if they had seen Stephen or Lynn, but Philip did not recall having seen Stephen and Lynn himself. Philip and Richard had both gone swimming in the Bayfield River at the bridge, and testimony would be provided by a woman named Donna Duncan, who claimed she drove her children down County Road and parked her car about 300 feet south of the bridge at around 7 p.m. Duncan said that when she arrived, she saw Richard Galatley leaving the bridge and heading south down County Road on his bicycle. She then saw Philip leave the bridge and head in the same direction on foot, almost immediately thereafter, and he even briefly stopped to speak with Duncan and her children. According to the Crown, since Richard had reported seeing Stephen and Lynn on the road, but Philip did not, this proved that Stephen must have taken Lynn into Lawson's Bush shortly after passing by Richard. However, as you're well aware, the memories of eyewitnesses who testify at criminal trials can often be unreliable, especially when you're dealing with children. Even though there were other witnesses who reported passing by Philip as he walked down County Road that night, he did not recall seeing them, which allowed the defense to plant the seeds that Philip could have passed by Stephen and Lynn, but just did not notice or remember them. It was also theorized that Donna Duncan may have been mistaken about having seen Richard and Philip leave the bridge right after one another, as Richard believed he did not start heading back to his house until around 7:20 p.m. rather than 7 o'clock. Philip's older brother Michael testified that Philip returned home at approximately 7:30, which fit with the timeline, since walking home from the bridge would have taken Philip approximately 30 minutes. And if Stephen was telling the truth about having left the school with Lynn at 7:25, then perhaps the reason Philip did not see them is because he was no longer on the road by that point. The two most crucial witnesses for the defense were 11-year-old Dougie Oates and 12-year-old Gord Logan, a pair of boys who claimed they were at the Bayfield River and saw Stephen and Lynn crossing the bridge together on their bicycle. Dougie said that he was trying to catch turtles in the river and specifically recalled waving at the two kids and Lynn smiling back at him as they rode past. Gord said that about 5 minutes later, he saw Stephen riding his bike across the bridge again in the opposite direction and this time Stephen was alone. If both these witnesses were telling the truth, this seemed to support Stephen's story that he crossed the bridge, dropped Lynn off at Highway 8, and then rode back to the school. Dougie and Gord both claimed that they were grilled hard by the police and prosecutors, who tried to push forward the idea that they were mistaken, and the boys felt like they were being pressured to change their stories. Since Gord was standing on a rock fishing in the river about 600 feet from the bridge, investigators argued that it was too far away for him to have seen anything, and even suggested that Gord may have been lying to protect Stephen because they were friends. But unlike Jocelyn Gaudette and Butch George, Dougie and Gord's accounts always remained consistent and they never wavered from their original stories. The most important witness for the Crown was Dr. John Peniston, who was the chief pathologist at Stratford General Hospital and had once been pathologist for the Attorney General of Ontario. Peniston performed Lynn's autopsy and would testify that based on the level of decomposition on Lynn's body and the partially digested food in her stomach, he believed that her time of death took place sometime between 7:15 and 7:45 p.m. on June the 9th. Lynn had her last meal at her family's house at approximately 5:45 p.m. that night, and Peniston testified that after emptying Lynn's stomach contents into a glass jar and then holding them up to a light in front of a window, he was able to figure out it was likely an undigested piece of food. He also said that he examined Lynn's small intestine and found nothing inside, which meant that the last food she ate had not yet transferred there from her stomach before she died. Since Dr. Peniston believed that it took a maximum of 2 hours for the stomach to empty, the timeline made him conclude that Lynn had to have been killed before 7:45 p.m. And Peniston's testimony was crucial for the prosecution, because if his assessment was accurate, this definitively placed Lynn with Stephen during the time period she was murdered. Of course, the defense argued that there was no way to determine a precise time of death for a victim based on their stomach contents, and attempted to discredit Peniston's testimony. Once again, they called upon their own expert witness, Dr. Berkeley Brown, who testified that stress, fatigue, and anxiety can be a factor in how long it takes for an individual to completely digest their food. If Lynn was being abducted by another individual, such as the driver of the car Stephen claimed he saw, then this could have caused enough stress to slow down Lynn's digestion process, placing her death at a later time. Well, at around 4:45 p.m. on September the 30th, after a two-week trial, the case would go to the jury, which consisted of 12 males. But there would be some controversy with Justice Ferguson's final instructions to them. One of the first investigators to doubt Stephen's story was Constable Donald Tremblay, who claimed that when he accompanied Stephen to the bridge near Highway 8 to share his account of what happened, he realized there was no way Stephen could have read the license number on a passing car from that distance. Well, this is a piece of misinformation which has often been circulated about this case, as it's been reported in some places that Stephen provided the license number for the car which picked up Lynn, but the authorities were unable to match it to any vehicles. But while it's true that Stephen did share a license number to the police, it was actually for another car which had passed by him on County Road. At no point did Stephen ever say that he saw the license number on the vehicle which Lynn climbed into, as he only mentioned seeing something yellow or orange on the rear fender. Well, when Justice Ferguson summarized this evidence to the jury, he mentioned that police tests have proven that it was not possible to see the numbers on a license plate from the bridge, which angered the defense, since Stephen never claimed to have seen any numbers. And this turned out to be a crucial mistake, because when one of the jurors was interviewed years later, they said that the discrepancy involving the license number was one of the things which influenced their verdict. But perhaps Ferguson's most shocking action was when he presented an all-new theory to the jury, which had never been pushed forward by the prosecution during the trial. Ferguson brought up the possibility that instead of Stephen killing Lynn in Lawson's Butch right after they left the school, he could have crossed the bridge over the Bayfield River and taken Lynn to Highway 8, but then they crossed over the bridge together again and headed in the opposite direction, back to Lawson's Butch, where Steve committed the murder at a later time. If Stephen was guilty, Ferguson's theory could have provided an explanation for why Dougie Oates and Gord Logan reported seeing him and Lynn at the bridge together, But the Crown never tried to present this theory, since they knew the timeline was too tight for Stephen to have traveled there and then gone back to Lawson's Bush to kill Lynn. After the jury began deliberations, defense attorney Frank Donnelly asked Justice Ferguson to bring them back into the courtroom no less than 5 times in order for Ferguson to clarify some of his misleading statements. Since it was late in the day and the jury appeared to be exhausted, some people felt they should have held off on deliberations until the following day, but at 10:55 p.m., after discussing the case for around 6 hours, the jury reached a verdict and found Stephen guilty of first-degree murder. They did put forth a recommendation for mercy, but since Canada still had a mandatory punishment for first-degree murder at that time, Justice Ferguson decided to impose the maximum penalty and sentence Stephen to death by hanging. Stephen's execution was originally scheduled to take place on December the 8th, just over 2 months after the conclusion of the trial, and he would continue to be held at the Huron County Jail in Goderich. Stephen had become the youngest death row inmate in the history of Canada, and needless to say, there was major controversy over the fact that a 14-year-old boy was going to be executed by hanging. There were a number of prominent individuals who were outspoken about this decision, including renowned Canadian writer Pierre Burton. While Burton said he did not have a concrete opinion about Stephen's guilt or innocence, he was against the idea of executing someone so young, and in the weeks following Stephen's conviction, he published a poem about this in the Toronto Star titled Requiem for a 14-year-old. Stephen received representation from a new defense lawyer named John O'Driscoll, who filed a motion to the Court of Appeal for Ontario, and they agreed to postpone his execution until February of 1960. However, on January the 20th of that year, 2 days after Stephen's 15th birthday, the Court of Appeal denied his motion for a new trial. But the government of Canada, led by Prime Minister John F. Diefenbaker, would obviously sense the rising public backlash over the case, so the day after the Court of Appeal's decision, they decided to commute Stephen's sentence to life imprisonment with no possibility of parole for 10 years. Following the commutation of his death sentence, Stephen was transferred from Goderich to the Collins Bay Penitentiary in Kingston for assessment, where it was determined that he would be incarcerated at the Ontario Training School for Boys in Guelph until he turned 18 years old and legally became an adult. After spending nearly 3 years at the training school, Stephen was transferred back to the Collins Bay Penitentiary following his 18th birthday in January of 1963, where he would continue serving his sentence of life imprisonment. While there, Stephen would be subjected to testing from a number of psychologists, which included undergoing hypnosis and polygraph testing, and he was even given truth serum and LSD. A good chunk of the testing was performed by Dr. George D. Scott, who had recently suffered considerable damage to his reputation due to his association with the notorious Quebec-based serial killer Léopold Dion, nicknamed the Monster of Pont Rouge. Dion had an extensive history of sexual offenses, but while serving time in prison in 1962, he was examined by Dr. Scott, who ruled that Dion was no longer a threat to the community and played a role in helping him secure parole. Well, following his release, Dion would go on to murder 4 boys, and he was rearrested within a year. It was theorized that in order to help seek some redemption for his role in this debacle, Dr. Scott wanted to finally garner a confession from Canada's most famous juvenile murderer, Stephen Truscott. But even after undergoing years of testing from Dr. Scott, Stephen never stopped maintaining his innocence in the death of Lynn Harper. Even though Stephen was now incarcerated, there were still a number of people who were not entirely convinced he was guilty. One of them was journalist Isabelle Le Bourdais, who published a book about the case in 1966 titled The Trial of Stephen Truscott, which pushed forward the narrative that Stephen had been wrongly convicted. The newfound publicity finally compelled the Federal Minister of Justice to refer the case to the Supreme Court of Canada, who agreed to hold a 5-day hearing in October of that year, in which both sides presented evidence supporting Stephen's guilt or innocence. What Stephen's defense team did not know at that time is that Dr. Peniston was planning to publish his autopsy findings for Lynn Harper in a medical journal, and before these hearings began, he sent a letter to Inspector Harold Graham, which contained a draft review of his findings. Peniston wrote that he had made a, quote-unquote, agonizing reappraisal of his testimony at Stephen's original trial. He admitted that he was no longer certain of his conclusion about Lynn's time of death, and now argued that his analysis of Lynn's stomach contents was more useful at excluding suspects rather than directly implicating anyone. At trial, Peniston had concurred with the Crown's theory that the lesions on Stephen's penis had been caused by sexual assault, which he described as a quote-unquote blind furious thrust of a male organ. But now Peniston had acknowledged that due to the lack of sperm found on Lynn's body, the injuries found to her vaginal area could have been caused by her being sexually assaulted with a blunt instrument. Naturally, Graham was none too thrilled that Peniston was now second-guessing himself and potentially undermining his original case. So Peniston's letter was never turned over to Stephen's defense team, and he was never called upon to testify at the Supreme Court hearing. When Peniston's autopsy findings were later published in the medical journal, the section in which he expressed his misgivings with the results was deleted. Now, it would be decades before anyone on Stephen's side ever heard about Peniston's letter to Graham, but to provide some historical context here, back in 1959, when Stephen's original trial took place, as well as in 1966, when the Supreme Court heard the case, prosecuting attorneys were not legally bound to turn all their evidence over to the defense. As you probably know, failure to turn over potentially exculpatory evidence is referred to as a Brady violation in the United States, named after the landmark 1963 U.S. Supreme Court case, Brady v. Maryland. While Canada would not have their own Supreme Court case like this until 1991, which was known as R. v. Stinchcomb. It was named after a court case in which a defendant named William Stinchcomb was convicted of breach of trust and fraud, but it turned out that an eyewitness statement favorable to Stinchcomb's case was withheld from his defense team, denying him the right to a fair trial. As the years went on, it turned out that a lot of potentially favorable evidence, including the aforementioned letter from Dr. Peniston, was withheld from Stephen Truscott's defense team in both 1959 and 1966, but like I said, I'll be going into more detail about that on our next episode. In January of 1967, the Supreme Court of Canada held a new set of hearings in which they heard testimony from 25 witnesses. This included Stephen Truscott, who took the stand to testify in his own defense for the very first time. However, by his own admission, Stephen was not adequately prepared, and since 6.5 years had now passed since Lynn Harper's murder, his recollection of certain details was not great. For instance, when asked if he had passed by Richard Gallatly riding his bicycle on County Road that night, Stephen said no, even though Richard had testified about riding past Stephen and Lynn on his own bicycle during his testimony at the original trial. Well, in the end, Stephen's testimony seemed to have a negative effect on the Supreme Court justices because on May the 4th of that year, it was announced that they had voted by an 8-1 decision to uphold the original conviction. Some of the justices described Stephen's testimony as quote-unquote vague and confused, and they did not believe he was entitled to a new trial. The lone dissenting opinion was written by Justice Emmett Matthew Hall, who believed that on the basis of some highly prejudicial and improperly admitted evidence and incorrect directions from Justice Ferguson in his charge to the jury, that a new trial should have been ordered. Stephen would continue serving his residence at the Collins Bay Penitentiary, and shortly after the Supreme Court's decision, he would receive some more bad news when his parents, Dan and Doris, revealed they were separating. The couple would later divorce, but still managed to remain banded together in their support for Stephen. During his time in Collins Bay, Stephen proved to be a model prisoner who caused no trouble and got along very well with the other inmates and staff. So in 1968, he was allowed to start living on the prison's farm annex, which had minimum security, and allowed inmates the opportunity to raise animals and harvest food. That same year, Stephen also earned the right to temporarily leave the prison grounds to attend English and political science classes at nearby Queen's University. Finally, on October the 21st, 1969, after having served 10 years behind bars, the now 24-year-old Stephen was granted parole. This decision was recommended by the National Parole Board and approved by the federal cabinet, but due to the publicity surrounding his case, the parole board was worried that Stephen would be hounded by reporters if he moved in with one of his parents. However, Stephen had developed a close relationship with the former prison chaplain, Malcolm Steinberg, who was now working as a parole supervisor, and Steinberg said that Stephen could come live with him and his family following his release. Due to the massive publicity surrounding his story, Stephen started living under the assumed name Stephen Bowers, which was his mother's maiden name. He was required to regularly check in with the National Parole Board, but they granted him permission to relocate to his original hometown of Vancouver, British Columbia, to live with his grandparents. It was here where Stephen met and began a relationship with a young woman named Marlene Withers, who had become familiar with his story after reading the book, The Trial of Stephen Truscott. Marlene was absolutely convinced that he had been wrongly convicted, and had even written letters to Stephen's parents to offer support before they had the chance to meet. In fact, she had even started a petition demanding a new trial for Stephen and collected 3,000 signatures. Stephen and Marlene eventually got married and moved to Marlene's original hometown of Guelph, Ontario, where he found work as a millwright. In November of 1974, Stephen was relieved of the terms and conditions of his parole by the National Parole Board, which finally allowed him to move and travel around freely, but he still said that his time in prison caused him to experience nightmares and suffer from anxiety, so he grew up as a very shy and distant person. Stephen and Marlene would go on to have a daughter named Leslie, two sons named Ryan and Devin, and some grandchildren, but even though Stephen had managed to build up a good life for himself, he still experienced an underlying urge to officially prove his innocence and get his name back. One particularly difficult situation occurred when his father Dan died of cancer in July of 1979, and Stephen told his kids that they couldn't go to their grandfather's funeral for fear that reporters might be there and they would take photos of the children and expose their identities. When each of his children got old enough, Stephen told them the full truth about his backstory, but all three of them would offer their undying support and said they had zero doubt that their father was not a murderer. The big turning point for Stephen occurred in 1997 when he was 52 years old and learned that David Milgaard, another Canadian who spent 23 years in prison for a rape and murder he did not commit, was finally exonerated via DNA testing. Even though the family was still living under the surname Bowers at this point, Stephen and Marlene decided that this might be the right time for him to put his case back into the spotlight and attempt to prove his innocence. After Stephen's children provided their blessing for him to do this, he got in touch with attorney and social justice activist James Lockyer, who was the founding director of the Association in Defense of the Wrongly Convicted. Lockyer had helped secure DNA testing for David Milgaard and another wrongly convicted man named Guy Paul Morin in order to fully exonerate them, so Stephen was hoping the same thing could be done for him. But unfortunately, he learned that all of the physical evidence from Lynn Harper's murder had since been destroyed. In spite of this, Stephen still wanted to bring his story back into the spotlight, so he got in touch with investigative journalist Julian Scher, who would go on to author the aforementioned book, Until You Are Dead. At the time, Scher was also a producer on the investigative documentary TV series The Fifth Estate, so arrangements were made to obtain all the original police files and court transcripts and produce an episode about Stephen's case. The episode, titled His Word Against History, aired in March of 2000, and for the first time in decades, Stephen agreed to appear on camera for an interview and revisit the locations in Clinton where Lynn's murder had taken place. Well, during the research for the show, a long-lost 900-page psychiatric file was unearthed for a promising alternate suspect in the crime. The file had originally been written in 1959, around the time of Lynn's murder, before it was misplaced, but when RCAF Station Clinton closed 12 years later, a senior officer found the file, and it wound up in the National Archives. The subject of the file was Sergeant Alexander Kalichuk, who served with the RCAF during World War II, and had once been stationed at the base in Clinton, where he worked as a supply technician until he was transferred in 1957. And interestingly enough, Lynn's father, Leslie Harper, happened to be the senior supply officer at that time, so Kalichuk likely met him at some point. Even though Kalichuk was transferred to RCAF Station Aylmer over 100 kilometers away, his wife, son, and two stepchildren continued living in a farmhouse located near RCAF Station Clinton, so Kalichuk frequently traveled back to the area in order to visit them. However, Kalachick was known for being an abusive alcoholic and had a documented history of sexual offenses, including two arrests for indecent exposure. On May the 29th, 1959, 3 weeks before Lynn's murder, Kalachick was driving on a county road near the town of St. Thomas, which is about 100 kilometers south of Clinton, when he noticed three young girls walking nearby. Kalachick then pulled over next to them and tried to lure one of the girls, who was only 10 years old, into his car by pulling out a pair of girls' underwear and offering it to her. However, the girl's father just happened to show up in his own vehicle, which prompted Kalachick to drive away, and he was soon tracked down and arrested by the OPP, who charged him with contributing to the delinquency of a minor. When Kalachick appeared in court 8 days later, a judge dismissed the charge against him due to lack of evidence, but gave him a stern lecture and warned that the authorities would be watching over him. Well, it turned out that on June the 9th, the very same day Lynn went missing, RCAF medical officers had a discussion about Kalachick's chronic alcoholism and his history of predatory behavior towards young girls. They also met with a probation officer to discuss a previous incident in which Kalachick had been arrested for indecent exposure in the nearby town of Seaforth. Later that year, Kalachick requested a transfer from Aylmer back to RCF Station Clinton, but the base was reluctant to have him there, particularly after Lynn's murder, so he was sent nearly 40 kilometers away to RCF Station Centralia. Now, there is no evidence that Kalachick killed Lynn, and there's nothing in the police files to indicate he was ever investigated as a potential suspect, so his whereabouts on the evening of June the 9th are unknown. It's worth noting that Kalachick did not own a gray 1959 Chevrolet at the time, but he recently bought a 1959 light yellow Pontiac Stratochief, and since it had large fins on the back, it's not impossible that Stephen could have mistaken a Stratochief for a Chevy from a distance. And even though the vehicle was brand new, Kalachick wound up selling the Stratochief not long after Lynn's murder. On July the 2nd, a medical officer at RCF Station Aylmer opened up a file on Kalachick and reported that he appeared to be suffering from overwhelming anxiety, depression, tension, and guilt, and diagnosed him with sexual deviation. A short time later, Kalachick checked into the psychiatric clinic of London's Westminster Hospital for treatment. It's been reported that Inspector Harold Graham was shown Kalachick's psychiatric file at some point, but showed no interest in it because Stephen had already been charged with Lynn's murder. For the next 15 years, Kalachick's life continued on a downward spiral, and he spent his last years in and out of psychiatric institutions before he died in a psychiatric hospital in 1975 at the age of 51. By the end of his life, Kalachick was reportedly wandering around the halls of the hospital looking disheveled and rambling incoherently thanks to his chronic alcoholism. Of course, Stephen and his supporters never even knew of Kalachick until his psychiatric file was uncovered during the late 1990s, and the Fifth Estate episode marked the first time he had ever been publicly mentioned as a potential suspect. Besides Kalachick, there are a couple of other intriguing alternate suspects, but I'll talk more about them in our next episode. Anyway, the airing of the Fifth Estate episode brought all new attention to Stephen's story, but one person who declined to be interviewed was Harold Graham, who wound up being promoted to Commissioner of the OPP in 1973 before he retired 8 years later. When Stephen's case returned to the spotlight, Graham continued to turn down all media requests for interviews before he passed away in November of 2001. Well, that very same year, James Lockyer filed a petition with the Federal Ministry of Justice to have the case reopened under Section 690 of the Criminal Code. Retired Quebec Justice Fred Kaufman was appointed by the federal government to review the case and held a series of hearings featuring new testimony from several witnesses, including Butch George and Jocelyn Gaudette, who had both not spoken about the case in over 40 years. When Butch testified, he finally admitted that Stephen had never asked him to lie to the police and conceded that he himself had given numerous false statements to incriminate Stephen, stating, quote, "Shit, we all lied." As for Jocelyn, she pretty much attributed her own inconsistent statements in the case to a bad memory. In April of 2004, Kaufman completed a 700-page report in which he concluded that, quote unquote, "there is reasonable basis for concluding that a miscarriage of justice likely occurred." While Kaufman acknowledged that there wasn't enough evidence to conclusively exonerate Stephen, he sent his report to the Federal Ministry of Justice. Well, in October of that year, after reviewing the report, Minister of Justice Erwin Kottler made this statement, quote, "I have determined that there is a reasonable basis to conclude that a miscarriage of justice occurred in this case." However, it appeared that Kottler was reluctant to make a decision about the case on his own, so he decided to refer it to the Court of Appeal for Ontario in order for them to review whether new evidence which had recently been uncovered might have changed the original verdict from Stephen's trial. Even though all the pieces of physical evidence from the case had since been destroyed, there was hope that Lynn Harper's body might contain traces of the killer's DNA. In April of 2006, the Attorney General of Ontario ordered her body to be exhumed, but a forensic examination of the remains turned up no usable DNA. Regardless, the case was soon brought before a 5-judge panel from the Court of Appeal for Ontario, who would hear about a bunch of newly uncovered evidence which was not available to Stephen's defense team when he went on trial back in 1959. So I guess you could say, you're gonna have to wait until next week. Sorry folks, I'll have to leave you on a cliffhanger, as this brings an end to part one of our series about the murder of Lynn Harper and the controversial conviction of Stephen Truscott. But I shall return next Wednesday with part two in order to share what happened during this new review of the case and then provide my theories and analysis about what happened. Anyway, another special thanks to listener Sarah Browning for narrating the opening of this episode. We've been carrying on this monthly listener voiceover contest for over 6 years now, and if you've already entered, you are automatically eligible for our next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see featured on this podcast. So once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. We also wanted to remind everyone that during the month of February, the Trail Went Cold has been teaming with a nonprofit organization called Season of Justice, which raises money for the families of cold case victims by helping spread awareness and attempting to fund such initiatives as DNA testing. If you would like to make a donation to Season of Justice, all of the information about them is listed in our show notes and on our social media pages, but you can donate by visiting the link givebutter.com/SOJ_thetrail, or by clicking a special donate button for them on our website, or by texting trail24 to 53555. That's givebutter.com/SOJ_thetrail, or you can text trail24 to 53555, or use the donate button on our website, trailwentcold.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 6 years, our Patreon page has released nearly 70 exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3. This past month, I released an episode about a very memorable case from Unsolved Mysteries, the disappearance of wanted fugitive Randall Utterback, who has not been seen since he broke out of jail nearly 30 years ago. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spinoff podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover another memorable case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1984 murder of Morris Davis. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have over 60 of those commentary tracks in our archives. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Benjamin S., Raphael L., John, Katie M., Madeline, and Blue Murder Club. Thank you all so much for your support. And before I bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for a brand new true crime podcast which has just launched called The Girl with the Same Name. This podcast will be exploring the unexplained 2002 death of Jamie Stickle, which I covered back on episode number 157 of The Trail Went Cold. And the reason it is titled The Girl with the Same Name is because the host of the show also happens to be named Jamie Stickle. Have a listen.
It started as a fire call this morning in the parking lot near the Heinz plant. A Jeep Wrangler was burned so badly the back tires had melted. But when firefighters put the fire out, they discovered a body inside.
Imagine getting a phone call from someone who has been dead for 21 years. For the people of Pittsburgh, hearing from Jamie Stickle 2 decades after her death must have been like getting a call from beyond the grave. My name is Jamie Stickle, and this is The Girl with the Same Name. On this season of The Girl with the Same Name, we are exploring the unsolved 2002 death of Jamie Stickle, a woman who shared not only my name, but a litany of coincidences and commonalities. We will talk to her friends, her family, her coworkers, the police, and the world-famous head coroner in Pittsburgh when Jamie died, Cyril Wecht. We will discuss the theories, hear the accusations, follow the money, and pursue justice for Jamie. Learn more, join the cause, and subscribe to the podcast at thegirlwiththesamename.com. First episode drops Thursday, February 15th, but you can subscribe right now on Spotify and all streaming platforms.
I'm also excited to announce that The Trail Went Cold will be returning again to the True Crime Podcast Festival this year, which is being held at the Denver Marriott Westminster Hotel in Colorado from July the 12th to the 14th. If you would like to purchase tickets, we have a discount code for 15% off, so please visit truecrimepodcastfestival.com and enter the promo code TRAIL. Once again, that's truecrimepodcastfestival.com, and the promo code is TRAIL for 15% off tickets. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. So have yourselves a good week and join us next Wednesday for part 2 of our special anniversary episode of The Trail Went Cold.